Chats, the show where I, Josh Pinkford, founder of Bear Metrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Nathan Berry, founder of ConvertKit. Nathan and I talk about being a maker as a kid, graduating high school at 15, being inspired by working in fast food, deciding when to pack it up or buckle down, and a heck of a lot more. Hope you enjoy. All right. Well, thanks for hopping on a call, Nathan.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
So one thing I talk to a lot of founders about here is like them as a kid. Like, I think that's fascinating. Is like, what were you like as a kid? Like, what were you into?
All right, let's see. I was super shy as a kid. Like, didn't like talking to other people. But I was always into making stuff. My dad had a woodworking shop. He built the house that we grew up in. And so, you know, he didn't have fancy tools, but he always had plenty of tools. So we grew up, you know, building swords and crossbows and all the important things that you should build as a child. And then, I probably had my first like entrepreneurial experience, like with woodworking and doing things like that, probably starting when I was like 10 or 11. And I'd, you know, make like these different wood crafts on a scroll saw and then, sell them around the neighborhood. So I was always into making stuff, and I had that modeled for me a lot of like, I guess probably the two biggest things I had modeled for me from my parents were, you know, just always build stuff. Like, even if you have no idea what you're doing, like, you can figure it out. And then also the second one would be from my mom. And that was just like always learning things. 'Cause she would just be like, you know what? Actually, I decided I wanted to learn Greek. And so I'm going to spend all this time like learning Greek, because why not? You know?
Sure. Do you think did the entrepreneurial stuff come from your parents at all?
Somewhat. They never did entrepreneurial stuff in like the, I guess the traditional sense, but, my dad ran a like Christian bookstore, you know, for 20 some years or so. And so that was never designed to be like a money-making venture, but it like has a lot of the characteristics of the typical entrepreneur path. And I'm sure it has the same emotional roller coaster of being an entrepreneur of it as well.
I worked at a Christian bookstore for a couple of years. So that's interesting. Yeah. I only thought I was getting robbed a couple of times. So it was fun.
Oh, actually robbed at all?
No, I never actually robbed. Just me, people, shady characters walking in and then me not being able to understand what they were saying and me just assuming that they were trying to rob me. this is like as a high school kid. The store was in a bad part of town, where like, gunshots were not uncommon. And we'd had people like break windows and stuff and steal Jesus statues, as one does.
That and Bibles. It's pretty common.
Right. You know, I mean, what else? There's not really anything else to steal in there. Yeah. It's interesting that you mention, you know, you making things like swords and stuff out of wood and then like wanting to sell them. So the typical like kid entrepreneur thing, I would say tends to be almost like more service based stuff. Like I cut grass for, you know, years and years and years, but was it more you making a thing and then trying to sell that? Or were you also into the, like, let me like do some service for someone?
It was usually making things, and it'd be like these, you know, I grew up in the mountains outside of Boise. And so, like I'd using a scroll saw and make these, like, I don't even know how to describe it, but like kind of this animal carving of sorts, but like a two-dimensional, animal carving, like a relief carving of sorts, and sell those around. And they were relatively easy to make. And because it was like up in the mountains, then like all these, you know, mountain animal themed things would sell really well. And everyone was like, oh yeah, of course I want to buy this thing that this 12-year-old made that was actually pretty decent, you know? Sure. I think we did this only services thing other than like a neighbor saying, hey, can I hire you to stack all this firewood or something like that? We had some friends who lived in like this, who lived maybe a mile away from us or so. And then when they moved away, they had this pet sitting business. of like, hey, you're going out of town. We'll check on your pets once or twice a day.
Yep.
And so they gave that to us, to me and one of my siblings. And that made good money because it was just like, ride your bike over to the neighbor's house, take care of the pets. And the rate was like 10 bucks a day.
Yeah.
And I just remember being like, whoa, this is good money. Sure. So I did that for a while.
So growing up, you're into making stuff, kind of selling some of that stuff. I mean, was it something where you kept doing that all through, I don't know, even through high school, or did it sort of like die off as you got a little bit older?
It probably started to die off as I needed to earn a bit more money. So, all of my friends were a couple years older than me and they were starting to go to college, or they're starting to, like, you know, senior year of high school, starting to think about going to college. And so I wanted to go to college as well, but, like didn't have the money to afford it. And like, I worked out this whole thing with my parents where, I let they would list out the exact work that I needed to do. Like, okay, you have to go this far in math. You have to, like, you know, as long as you complete pre-calculus and, you know, all these things in all these different areas, then you can consider yourself graduated, because I was homeschooled. So instead of spending 4 years in high school, I just got this giant checklist of everything that had to be done and like went through all of that. So, like we would take these 8-hour drives to visit family in Seattle. And, I remember thinking like, well, I'm really bored doing algebra and I'm really bored on these 8-hour drives. So why don't I just combine the two? And I would do like a month or a month and a half worth of math lessons on the drive to Seattle. Just be, and like my older siblings would be there in the car with me. And so like, I could ask them questions and, you know, they had nothing better to do than answer and like explain algebra 2 to me.
You've trapped them in the car. They can't go anywhere.
Yeah. So I was able to get really far ahead. And so I graduated, high school, not long after turning 15. Wow. And so then I like, and the whole point was so I could go to college where my friends were going, which is, you know, Boise State. But I needed a way to pay for it. And so, cause there were scholarships that I could get, but then oddly enough, a bunch of them I couldn't get cause I was too young. That was frustrating, but I remember picking up the phone book and like going through to all of like the fast food places and just calling them and asking them, hey, what age do you hire at? And they'd all be like 16. And I'm like, damn it, you know, and then move on. Yeah, yeah. And then Wendy's was the first one that, that said, hey, we'll hire at 15. And so that kind of ended the, I guess the selling things around the neighborhood as I just transitioned to like, it was to fast food. Cause I mean, it was more consistent money. And then that's how I paid for like the first year of college tuition.
Was working fast food. Oh man. That's fantastic. So how long did you work at Wendy's?
A year and a half, 2 years. I think a year and a half.
Did you,
I got an internship. Yes, I did actually. Because they had okay, this is me nerding out in business now. They had everything down to a perfect system.
Sure.
Like just flawless. And where you could take like any person who like had no idea what they're doing, only kind of wanted to be there and like get them to like fill their role in this perfect system.
Sure.
And there was like 3 or 4 of us there that kind of became obsessed with like streamlining it even more. And we started this rivalry with this other, with 2 other local Wendy's locations as to, how fast we could serve, everyone through the drive through during the lunch rush, you know? And cause there was this timer and it would keep track of like that every car from when you pulled up to the speaker to when you left with your food. And, so we would call them up and be like, you know, I don't know about you, but we're going to pull off 82 seconds today. What are you going to get? You know? And they'd be like, oh, you know, so we get this rivalry growing and we would pick our, be like, I don't know, Joe can't, like, he's not going to be making sandwiches or working the grill for us today. We need somebody better. You know, we were like, who was like
substituting super, super efficient.
Yeah. And so we'd actually have a really good time because, at one point we set I can't even remember the numbers from it, but people from like Wendy's corporate showed up and were like, hey, by the way, I don't know if you guys know this, but you guys are consistently setting like the national record for like how fast you're serving everyone through the drive-thru. And we were like, cool, because we're having fun doing it.
That was the goal.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize they kept track of it on like a national store scale, but sure. we had a lot of fun. And I loved working really, really quickly, because all throughout high school, college, I mean, all throughout everything, there had been this idea ingrained in me by my parents that, hey, don't do anything for a set amount of time. Mm-hmm. Just do it until it's done. Get it done as fast as possible. So I remember like, you know, sometimes, you know, being homeschooled, sometimes school for a day might take 5 hours, say. Mm-hmm. But if it was snowing outside and we wanted to go sledding, it's amazing how, like, it wasn't, my mom never said, okay, you need to sit here for 5 hours and do all the stuff. She was like, yeah, there's all the homework. There's all that stuff that you have to get done. And when it's done, you can go sledding.
Yep.
And you can get 5 hours of work done in an hour and a half if you're motivated enough to go sledding.
Sure.
And so like Wendy's fed into that of like, oh no, we're just going to, obviously we still got paid by the hour, but we were able to make it fun of like, okay, how can we perfect this system? And whatever everyone else is like slogging through, we're just like, no, no, no.
you're like screaming at other people, faster, faster.
Yeah. I was like this 15 or 16 year old who's like, all right,
everyone hates you.
Well, there was like five of us who thought we had the most fun. I've always applied that to everything. Like when I started doing freelance web design, which I guess I got into that because I dated this girl in high school who was like making websites on GeoCities. Back when like the animated GIFs were not like jokes, but like, I mean, for her stuff.
That's like how you designed stuff was an animated sparkly under construction GIF.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a lot of that stuff. And I remember when she showed me like, hey, look at this thing that I made. And I like typed this hex code into Notepad and then like the background color changed. I thought that was super cool. So once I learned web design and started to get clients, then I had that same approach of like, oh, no, I'm not going to build by the hour because that doesn't reward me for the one thing that I'm super good at, which is being really, really like getting results really quickly. So sure. I'd always build by the project.
So, okay. So you're working at Wendy's to pay for college. Did you finish college?
No, my claim to fame when it comes to college is that I dropped out at 17. So after 2 years and before most people have the chance to drop out of high school. So.
Right.
I did 2 years at Boise State, first for graphic design, and then I decided I hated the art department. Because when I said graphic design, I meant like all the stuff that I was doing in Photoshop and then starting to do on the web. And when they said graphic design, they meant art. And I was like, you and I don't see eye to eye on this. I switched to marketing.
And did you enjoy the marketing stuff?
No, because I never got into the marketing classes. I was stuck in like intro business.
Yeah.
That I don't know. So, another year and I would have gotten into like the actual, like, I don't know, 300 level marketing classes.
Right.
I might have liked that, but.
So did you drop out because you were bored or because it just like paying for it was tough or?
I dropped out because I was in school to learn how to make money.
Yeah.
And to you know, get so I, like for a career to earn more money because I really like to earn money. Yep. I was starting to like my freelance web design stuff was really taking off. And so I realized like, wait, I'm probably making more or as much money now as I would expect to make out of school.
Right.
But I'm also still paying for school and I like making money more than spending it. And so
I'll just keep the money.
I'll just not, you know, and like Boise State is not an expensive school. I don't know what it was like 6,000, 7,000 a year. It was probably more than that, you know, but somewhere right in there. But I was like, you know what would be better is if I just worked.
Spend.
So I got like a $5,000 web design gig and then like a $10,000 like full app software design gig where I had to like contract out some of the development. And then I was like, okay, I think I can make this work.
So did you go, I mean, immediately go from dropping out of college to doing the freelance stuff, or did you go work somewhere?
No, immediately into the freelance stuff. And I was freelancing through college. I basically, as it took more and more of my time and I had less time for school, I was like, and maybe I just won't go back this semester.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I freelanced for about a year and had a really good year of freelancing. And that put us in early 2008, or let's see, the end of that year was end of 2008, or early 2009. Mm-hmm. And I went on a 5-week trip to South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't make any money during that time. And then when I came back, like beginning of 2009, it was solidly the recession.
Yes.
And so I heard from a bunch of people, like I went to pick up all these conversations that I've been having. I'm like, hey, let's start a project. And everyone was like, look, we're not spending money till our clients spend money.
Yep.
And then I had one client who was like, we have freelance work, but we'd really prefer you join full time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up joining them, to lead their like software design interface stuff. And I was there for 3 years.
Oh, cool. So like what kind of software were you guys designing?
We did a bunch of stuff, but it was a lot of things around video delivery on the web. So particularly for like hospitals and like patient education and stuff like that.
So,
they were a small company when I joined.
Were you guys an agency technically, or were you guys actually building software?
Actually building software and then selling it. There would definitely be services work that came along with it.
Yep.
In order to make the sale, but it was set up as a software product, though, like more enterprise sales type of thing rather than, you know, they were like selling $100,000 to $1 million deals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rather than like, hey, sign up for this for $500 a month.
Gotcha.
So there'd be custom dev to go with it. And then we had a video production department eventually. It like grew, it was 14 people when I joined and grew up to like 90 people.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but it was all like VC funded and it went down the other side as well.
And was this in Boise? You
know? Yep, in Boise.
Gotcha.
Yeah. They raised like $30 million in venture capital over 5 years or something.
And this in the early, or I guess late 2000s?
Yeah, like because I joined in 2009 and then left the very end of 2011. So... yeah.
Okay. So,
the ride.
So you're there for 3 years, and then I guess what made you want to leave working for them to go back to doing your own thing?
Yeah, I'd wanted to go back to doing my own thing for a while, but I wanted more stability in it. Mm-hmm. And so on the side, I started building iPhone apps and got those a couple iPhone apps to the point where they were making a couple grand a month pretty consistently.
Yep.
And so my idea was like, hey, if I go back to freelance, but I actually have the stable, like baseline cash flow of like, I don't know, cause in Boise, especially as a single guy, though, I guess I was married at that point. But married, no kids, like you can live, I mean, not great, but you can get by on $2,000 a month.
Sure.
So I was like, ooh, the iPhone apps can cover that. And then, like other things, you know, then I'm actually going to freelance on top of that. And so, but like, ooh, the idea that my worst month ever could be $2,000, like that makes freelancing a really, really great idea.
Right, right, right.
Like takes the, like cuts the valleys out of that emotional roller coaster.
Yep.
Of like business cash flow that anyone who's freelanced has experienced.
Sure, totally. So, I mean, so, you know, you mentioned you're married at that point. So like, what was your wife's response to quitting your job to go back to being self-employed?
She'd known I wanted to for a long time. She was totally in favor of it. She's just always been ridiculously supportive.
Yep.
And so, cause I actually left my job 2 weeks before our son was born.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. And it was kind of a good reminder of like, I don't want to be doing this. Like life is moving forward.
Yep.
You know, it's time to, and the other company was having layoffs and,
You
know, you have to go through a couple rounds of layoffs and you still have your job. You're like, that's great, but I don't want to be here anymore.
Well, like the stability being like one of the reasons that you even had the job in the first place kind of becomes clear that there's not really anything such as job stability, right? Or
right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. And you just, I think of that as like, oh, great. Now there's a single point of failure instead of freelancing. At least I have five.
Oh, right, right.
You know, 5 points of failure of like, it's, or, you know, I've diversified my income slightly so that if one client fires me, I'm not like, you know, desperately searching for income.
Right, right, right. So what was, I mean, what was the plan? So you were you interested in building like a company at all at that point, or was it just about being self-sufficient?
Self-sufficient, but I wanted to do products. Like I, at this point I'd done freelancing for quite a while. I guess quite a while, it's all relative. Sure. You know, I'd done that kind of thing, and I tried to productize it as much as possible of like, hey, I'll build this iPhone app for you for $10,000 rather than like, yeah, let's see where the hours end up, you know? But I really wanted to sell products. All the blogs that I read were like, if anyone was talking about, hey, I made this much money from an iPhone app, like you better believe that I read that article.
Sure.
Or like details on growing an audience or all that stuff. Anyone self-publishing books or courses, I read all of that stuff. And that was always the goal of, okay, how can we get to selling products? And so the iPhone apps were the first products there. And then I ended up writing a book called the iOS Handbook, or the App Design Handbook. That did, you know, that was my first experience like selling to an audience, because I'd built up a pre-launch list for that. And that sold $12,000 worth in the first 24 hours. And I was like, okay, there's something here. Like, sure. Let's stop freelancing. And now I'm all of a sudden I've gone from like, let's put this thing out here and see if it sells, to like, yep, I'm a professional blogger and content creator now. And like, I'm going to write another book.
So I'm curious, like how you even arrived at the point where you decided like the idea to even do products instead of consulting or some sort of services. I mean, like how did it even register for you that, hey, maybe I could, you know, do these things? I was like, either both the consulting as like you're selling a full product package deal instead of hours, or even just writing an ebook and selling that. Like, how did that end up on your radar?
Yeah, that's a good question. It probably started with like 4-hour work week.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to think when I read that, it was probably 2008 or something. And that's kind of got me thinking down that road of like opening up those doors. And then from there, from like Tim's blog, I ended up finding Chris Guillebeau's blog, and he talked a lot about like audience building and selling digital products. And then, you know, being in the software space, I'd always read all the stuff from the guys at Basecamp. And so kind of that mix of things of like, okay, I'm starting to see the power of products, the power of audience, and just getting like totally immersed in this world.
So did the idea of ConvertKit, was that just sort of this natural evolution of, hey, I've sold ebooks, I've sold, you know, apps, I've sold my consulting even as its own sort of little product? Was a SaaS product sort of just the natural next thing to try? Or I guess, what was the motivation?
Yeah. For that? A couple of motivations. One, at that point, I'd written and sold 2 books on designing software. And I felt like I was talking about how to design software, but was starting to get out of experience. And like, I hadn't actually designed any software in a while.
Yep.
Which I remember that feeling pretty strongly, though. Now when I look back on it, it had been like 5 months that I hadn't done any software design. And I felt like, man, I'm getting so rusty. Like, I don't know. I feel like a bit of an imposter, sure, like telling people to do that, how to do this. And I'm like, I don't even do it at all anymore. And looking back, I was like 5 months max, right? You know? And so like, maybe I didn't need to feel that as strongly as I did. But, you know, so looking back on that, that was part of it. I wanted, like, my background is software design. That's my skill set. And so I wanted to actually be designing software again. And then the other part is I'd done these 2 launches. One had done 12,000 in 24 hours. The next one had done like 25,000 in 24 hours. And I started to see like, okay, there's these big spikes, but there's this valley that comes after it. And actually those two launches were so close together that I don't even know why I was concerned about this. Cause at this point it brought in quite a bit of revenue, but like, in, you know, looking back then, you know, I was like, oh man, I don't want to be stuck to this launch driven model. I want recurring revenue. And so like those two things made it. So it's like, okay, it's time to start a software company. And I didn't know what software company to start, but, you know, I launched into it, publicly said, hey, I'm going to build a software company. You can follow along on my blog. The goal is to get to 5,000 a month in revenue. And, you know, in 6 months.
Yep.
And, then ConvertKit came pretty quickly. Cause I was like, actually, I need a better email tool. Like all of my sales are coming from email.
Right, right.
Like let's, I can do better than MailChimp and, build something just for myself.
I love how that, like, the impetus was, so you've got this existential crisis from like not designing something for a couple of months and then launching really successful ebooks that make you tens of thousands of dollars in a short period of time. And you're like, this isn't enough. Like, so you're like, I need software. But I mean, hey, you know, so be it. So,
right.
So, okay. So you do the, like this, I don't know, self-described like web app challenge thing. You build ConvertKit, launch that. The goal was to do what, $5,000 in MRR in 6 months. Like,
yeah,
you know, that didn't happen.
Right.
And it was kind of like 2 years of ConvertKit just like sitting there more or less. Right. And you're doing ebooks at the same time. Or you're still like at this point just basically living off of the prior sales of ebooks.
I'm still doing ebooks. So I got to the point where I was pulling in about 200 to 250,000 consistently every year from ebooks. Mm-hmm. And so that was the primary driver of everything.
So are you, I mean, during that the first couple of years of ConvertKit, are you even working on ConvertKit much at all, or is it still just like the ebook thing kept working, so you were trying to do both?
I was doing both. So I'd put probably 20 hours a week into both, and then, you know, another 10 hours a week into like all the other goofing off of like learning stuff and trying things out and, you know, that kind of thing that, like that work where it's like you do a full work day and then you hang out with your kids and family and all of that. And then like somehow at 9 o'clock, you find yourself back at the computer for an hour and a half.
Still doing like something, that, not sure what.
Yeah, exactly. So I did lots of that.
Okay. So, I mean, the first 2 years of ConvertKit, I mean, growth, for the most part, declined. I mean, you got up to a certain point, but it also was just less.
Yeah, it got 2,000 a month, or I think 2,200 a month was the like all-time peak.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of just tapered off from there. Like it stayed flat and then tapered off. Then I started to lose motivation as like, sure. If I can't make this thing grow, then.
But why do you think growth actually declined over those 2 years instead of grew?
I think we weren't mature enough as a product. I wasn't putting in super consistent marketing efforts. And it's like, if something's brand new, it's easy to get people to be like, cool, I'll check it out. Like there's this exciting factor of it being new. And then people will quickly realize like, oh, this doesn't have everything that it needs to, like all MVPs.
Mm-hmm.
But then like if they see it improving fast enough and they like you and, you know, they like the direction of the product, then they'll stick with it. Right. But if it's not improving fast enough, then they'll just bounce. And so we had a lot of that, of it just like, I was building it on such a cash constrained budget of like it just trying to make it fund itself, that they're just like, you couldn't hire enough development time. You couldn't.
Sure.
It wasn't really making progress.
But do you feel like you had spent the prior few years on this ebook sort of sales cycle where you build up some hype to an ebook launch, and even though you could sort of relaunch the ebook over and over again with updates and whatnot and different pricing packages, but it was still based on these big surges of, you know, press or signups and all that. Do you feel like that hurt the initial launch of ConvertKit? Like, were you focused on almost like treating it like its own, like it was an ebook?
About a year in, I tried that again of like a different model. Mm-hmm. 'Cause yeah, I really only knew how to sell ebooks, and that launch driven model. And that's hard to do with SaaS. There's a few companies that still continue to do it. And now I kind of make fun of them because right. I'm like, guys, you don't release version 5.0 of your SaaS product. Right. Like the moment you put a version number in your SaaS, like all of us software guys start making fun of you.
Right.
But I didn't know how to drive like these consistent sales. I knew how to build up the hype and then have urgency in a launch and do all of that. And so that ended up being hard to drive consistent sales.
Yep. Yep. So then what, I mean, 2 years in, you know, growth is actually lower than it was earlier at the early days of it. But then something changed. I mean, like what changed for you mentally that ultimately resulted in some change in growth?
Yeah. So, I was at MicroConf in Vegas and had a conversation with Heaton Shaw, and he was like, "Hey, you should shut down ConvertKit." I remember thinking, like, that's not a nice thing to say. Right. Like, dude, I've put a lot of work into ConvertKit. Like, don't just tell me, you know, just shut it down. But then he continued and was like, look, you know, you're going to be successful at whatever you, like, you've proven through book, like, you can make money on the internet. You can build an audience. ConvertKit's not working. You should shut it down. Or take it seriously and, like, go all in on it and give it the time, money, and attention it deserves, and you can build it into something real. But, like, clearly whatever you're doing is not working. And so shut it down or double down. And so I always joke that I did what everyone does when they hear really good advice. And that was waiting 6 months to take any action on it whatsoever. So I went from like, he told me that it must've been April. And in October I was like, okay, I got to decide. I've got to shut it down or double down. Yep. And that's 'cause it wasn't even covering like its email sending infrastructure, like basic bug support bills anymore, yep. You know? And I basically decided, and I wrote a whole blog post on this, you know, should I shut it down or double down? And I came up with a simple question framework. And the first one was, do you still want this as much today as you did when you started? So for me, it was like, I can sell ebooks and courses all day long. And I don't like, I'm not going to complain about only making 200,000 a year, 250,000 a year.
Yep.
Like that's a great business. And so do I actually even want to like go down the software route? Do I want to be like the CEO of a software company? And if not, that's totally fine. Just like shut it down, walk away. That's fine. No one's going to think any less of you. And I thought about it. I'm like, no, I still want this just as much as the day that I started. I was like, okay, so proceed to question number two. And that's, have you done everything possible to make this succeed? You know? And so when I thought about it, or like, have you given this every possible chance? And so I thought about it, I was like, well, okay, I have only put in like $5,000 of my own money. I'm working on it part-time and like my attention is like going to these other things. And so I was like, no, if I shut it down now, I'll always have this nagging feeling of like, could I have made that work? And so that told me that, okay, I need to go all in on it because there's this disconnect between what I say I want and then the amount of effort that I'm putting in. And so I needed to actually give it like a real try. And so to me that meant actually hiring an in-house developer. So not just contractors, but hiring someone in-house who could focus on it full time, investing a real amount of money. So all the money I had was $50,000 in savings. So I put all of that into the company and then, you know, actually like trying new sales tactics. So instead of selling through content, I started selling through, through direct sales, and that really started to kick things off. So we were at 1300 a month in revenue. Or I guess the last thing was picking a specific niche so changing our marketing. And so we went to email marketing for authors and then eventually email marketing for bloggers. And so focusing on that, we went from 1300 a month in revenue to 1600 a month, mostly through those direct sales, then 2000 a month and 2500 and then you know, 3,000. And so 6 months after that decision, we were at 5,000 a month in revenue. And then, by the summer, so that was in April, by June, we were at like, I think 10,000 a month. And then July was a fantastic month. It was 15,000 a month. We started to get some more influential customers. And then later in, you know, a few months later, they started talking about it, like Pat Flynn and others, started saying like, oh yeah, we use ConvertKit. And, so then, you know, that 15 turned into 18, turned into 25. And by the end of the year, we were at 98,000 a month. So in 13 months or 14 months, we went from 1300 a month to 98,000 a month.
That's not too bad.
It'll work.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's backtrack a tiny bit here. So, you mentioned the $50,000 in savings. So at this point, I mean, you've got, you were, very much married, you've got kids. I mean, what's spending the, you know, your savings to make this thing happen that for 2 years prior has very much not worked. I mean, like what was your wife's response that time? I mean, obviously she was super supportive, you know, going to be to self-employed, but now it's like, you've got, there's a lot more at stake at this point.
Yeah. And we'd been making good money, but, had just bought a house, you know, and that was like a $60,000 or $70,000 down payment. Yep. And then spent about $80,000 remodeling it. And so we'd gone from having like a really good nest egg and savings to like, okay, this 50,000 is all we've got left.
Right.
And part of the reason for that, there's a part of the story that I don't tell that often. And that's, when my second son was born. So when would that have been? 2014. May 2014, he was like the easiest kid ever. Like the first 2 weeks, I was like, wow, this is fantastic, you know? Then both kids got sick at the same time. And we had all this other stuff going on. We were remodeling the house. I was the general contractor on the remodel, you know, still running my blog and everything. Right. And so what ended up happening is at one point I had like noticed this, like both kids were not sleeping and they would do the thing that I'm sure you've probably experienced where they're like, the kids decide to alternate when they're going to wake up.
Yes.
They're like, don't worry, we'll wake up every two and a half hours.
Yep.
But we're going to take turns.
So it results in you getting zero sleep.
Yeah. And I remember like, you know, my wife's just, given birth to this kid like 2 weeks earlier. So I'm going to be, I'm going to like step up and do my part.
Right.
And so, I tried all of that and ended up getting no sleep. But, then one day I noticed this like rash starting to develop on my leg and I was like, that's weird. I was thinking like diet or laundry detergent or like, you know, something's different. And I eventually go to the doctor for it and they're like, yeah, you've got shingles. which I thought only old people got, but,
and also, but all sleep deprived parents also.
Yes. And so they're like, is there anything going on in your life that would cause you to like have an increase of stress?
And I was like, I haven't slept in 3 weeks.
Yeah. And they're basically like, that'll do it. And so I remember they were like, here's some antivirals to take. And then also like, here's a prescription for painkillers. And I was like, that's okay. Like I've got all this business stuff that I want to get to. And I don't like what painkillers do to my head.
Yep.
And I want to think clearly and like the pain's, you know, it's frustrating, but it's not significant.
Yep.
And they were like, you sure? And I was like, yes. And then turns out they had a bet going in the office as to how long it would be before I called them back to ask for that prescription. It took 5 hours. And they were just like, so when I called back, I was like, actually, can you call on that prescription? They're like, we already did. It's waiting for you. And so that kind of resulted in like 5 or 6 months of, like getting over that, you know, 3 months of getting over that. And then, it took me like 6 months or more before I felt like I got any level of productivity back.
Yeah.
I don't know if you run into this, but for me, like I derive a lot of my self-worth from what I accomplish.
Sure.
And so it ends up being kind of this downward spiral of like, I don't know, productivity, depression, like all of that. It's just like, I can't get work done. And because I can't get work done, I'm even more down. And so I am even less able to get work done.
Yeah.
So actually I have this, I had this conversation with Hillary, my wife, and when we were deciding to double down on ConvertKit, like kind of at the end of this period. And, I maybe someday I'll use this in a podcast or something, but cause I have it recorded, but, I've heard you saying like, yeah, I was totally supportive of you of going all in on ConvertKit because I didn't know what else you would do because you didn't really do anything back then.
You just stared at a wall.
Yeah, kind of. And she like, we had enough money coming in from the ebooks that like, we, you know, the mortgage wasn't going to fail. But like all of that had dropped off. It had gone from averaging 20K a month down to like 8K a month or something and was not on a good path.
Right.
So yeah, she was just like, she was totally supportive. And
do you feel like they were on some level, it was almost like she had seen you just being so down and not productive or anything for, you know, nearly half a year that it almost felt like you needed something to get excited about?
Yeah. So she was like, kind of willing to try anything at that point.
Right.
And she was like, well, he seems excited about, like, he seems to at least have some direction on this.
Yeah.
And so it seems worth trying. And she was saying like, look, worst case scenario is if all of this doesn't work, then like we sell the house that, or, you know, default on the house that we just bought and remodeled and like move in with her parents or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. Worst case scenario is like, I start doing some consulting again.
Sure. I think like,
and so her worst case scenario was way worse and she was totally fine.
She was still fine with it. Right. Like I think there's, a pretty common thread, you know, from talking to a bunch of other founders about this kind of stuff too, is, especially, I mean, founders that are married, and maybe even have kids, having your spouse or partner be, not only just supportive, but have like a pretty high tolerance of risk or like being okay with the ups and downs and being able to absorb that pretty well is pretty common thread.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, super helpful.
Yeah, Hillary's,
you know.
Yeah, Hillary has an amazing, I don't know that in anything that she would do personally. Yeah. She has a super high risk tolerance, but like, she's very tolerant of me taking on large amounts of risk. So
do you think, you know, you put all these changes into place, you know, spend 50,000 euro money, really double down on, kind of doing the direct sales stuff, the outreach, all that kind of stuff. Do you think you could have done those same set of changes 2 years prior to the same effect?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe it was also like me getting to a certain point or like a amount of dedication or something like that. But yeah, there was nothing magical about waiting. And I remember telling Heaton Shaw later on, of like, hey, I finally decided to take your advice and double down on this. And him being like, cool, but it might be too late because like ActiveCampaign is doing a bunch of great moves. Like Drip had kind of a flat period for a while and they're seeing a resurgence and they're like making a lot of traction now. And like Aweber's doing all these updates. And so he was like, look, and I don't know if he told me this because he like 100% truly believed it, that we were maybe a bit too late, or he wanted to just like motivate me even more. But he was like, look, you may have missed the opportunity. Like I gave you the advice 6 months ago and you got to realize that 6 months is a long time in the startup world.
Sure.
And you might have just missed it.
Yep.
And so, yeah, like ideally, if we'd come out with the, I think in the first 6 months of ConvertKit, I wouldn't change much about what I did there. But from 6 months on, like if I could have maintained that momentum and started the direct sales, and like I think it would have changed the trajectory of the company for sure. And we easily could have shaved 2 years off of the, you know, the growth plan and everything else.
Which, but, you know, if 6 months is a long time, I mean, 2 years Yeah. That's pretty significant.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, I learned a lot. Certainly don't have any regrets from the process, sure. But it's like, yeah, if I would have started the direct sales and get out there and hustle a lot sooner, ConvertKit would be a bigger company.
Today. Right. So, okay. So the past 2 years, you guys have had, a lot of growth. So you went from making a couple $1,000s a month to today you guys are doing almost 10 million a year. What's been the hardest part of that? Either, I don't know, mentally, not so much from a product standpoint, but like what's for you been this really hard part about managing, basically nothing to 10 million?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is growing and staying profitable is super hard.
Yep.
And so it ends up being really stressful to not have cash in the bank. Or there were times when we were doing $100K a month in revenue and had $97,000 a month in expenses and $30,000 in cash in the bank.
Right.
And so we realized hey, our cash balance is growing every month, but our cash balance as a function of days worth of expenses is last week we had 2 weeks of expenses in the bank.
Yep.
And now we have slightly more money, but it's really only 11 days of expenses now.
Yep.
And so that was definitely hard and definitely stressful. And that was okay, now I get why people raise money. And then later on, the next year we did, so in 2016, we did $1 million in profit on $4.1 million in revenue. Cause we shifted so far to be okay, let's get as profitable as possible.
Yep.
But then what really sucks is paying out so much of that in taxes.
Oh, sure.
$450,000 of that goes to taxes. And yep. So then it's wait, we just built up this nest egg, and then it's you have to pay taxes on it. So that's another advantage of, I don't know why I'm giving all these advantages to raising money, but it's coming to mind right now, even though I'm glad that I didn't raise money.
Sure.
But, if you get this cash in, you're not having, you get this nest egg that you can count on.
Yep.
And you get it right away rather than having to it's just so much work to save up that cash on hand.
Well, I think a lot of people also, the other alternative there is to spend some of that, right? To operate, not necessarily right at break even, but I mean, if you spend some of that, then you're not having to pay as much on taxes, which I think a lot of companies do, but that's a fine line too. That's that kind of the stress that you mentioned about profitability, it kind of maintains the stress, right? Cause you have to keep up the stress operating at near break even.
Yeah, I think so. And you just have to, we weren't disciplined with our books.
Yep.
And finances until, as we got into 2016, we started getting all of that together.
Right.
And so, at some point you're just watching the bank balance. You're seeing the Stripe deposits come in every day. And you're like, hey, watch that. That's great. That's growing. And then you're like, oh shoot, we ran up $40,000 on the credit card. And early on, you're watching the cash flow from that perspective and maybe not from an accounting perspective.
Yep.
And you need both, really, because I've seen people get so caught up in accounting. They're like, based on our accrual accounting methods, this, and you're like, yeah, but you're accruing that expense over the next 12 months, but you had to pay for it today.
Right.
So here's the deal. You don't actually have that money that
you think you have.
That your right. books that. Yeah. And so I don't know. That was definitely a stressful time, but I'm trying to think of other things that have been particularly rough.
The growing the team, has that been an enjoyable thing for you?
For the most part.
Yeah.
There's some early learnings. I had to make a pretty key fire. Mm-hmm. Maybe about the time that we were at 120,000 a month in revenue.
Yep.
And that was painful because the probably half the team or a quarter of the team for sure thought that was letting this person go was totally the wrong move.
Yeah.
And it ended up being totally the right move, but it took a lot of convincing.
there's this like huge,
yeah, it, you know, and I just made the call,
right? I mean, yeah, you know, like the, I think that's the hardest part of like building a team is the, is like your CEO and resident psychologist that's,
yes,
having to like balance the, you know, the needs and human emotions of a whole group of people.
Right. Yeah. So that was rough. Also just like scaling the product, like from an infrastructure side of like, we now send hundreds of millions of emails every month. Yep. And then, oh, you know what would be fun today? Like a denial of service attack. Let's do that. That sounds great. And then, you know, stuff like that. So like our first team retreat, we'd finally, was a big deal. And it's funny to look back on now, cause like I remind some of the early people like, hey, remember when we were just trying to save up enough money so we could have a team retreat? When you're like, let's do a team retreat. Oh wait, we can't afford it. And like, but so when we finally went on our first team retreat, which was last summer, so August 2016, we got like this denial of service attack the day that we're all supposed to start doing things. So it was like paddleboard trip that, you know, we're all going to go paddleboarding down this river. And then all the engineers are like, actually, we're going to sit in this coffee shop and like do whatever we can to fix this because who knows what's going on, you know? And that was painful. Like customers were upset, as like we had all kinds of trouble scaling, and obviously we got through it, but sure, still a pain.
So I mean, the anything other than the infrastructure sort of scaling, the things that come with that, besides that, is there any other part of the fast growth that you have not enjoyed?
I don't think so. I mean, fast growth is generally a good thing. Positive. And it brings, yeah. it's stressful, and I definitely felt like for a year or more I was just on all the time, and like and so, you know, my wife likes to point out that she's like, well, I'm gonna get my hair cut, this is like, I don't know, 4 months ago or something, and the person cutting my hair was like, oh yeah, you got more gray hairs coming in here. And I was like, more gray hairs? I didn't know I had any. And I went home and told Hillary that. And she was like, oh yeah, you've had them for a long time. I just didn't want to tell you. and so we were joking that like, you know, that comes from the rapid growth. Right.
Well, I mean, it's like, they show pictures of like before and after of presidents.
Right.
Oh, it's the same for, you know, people who run a business.
Yeah, friends don't let friends become president.
So the inverse of that, obviously there's some downsides and, you know, struggles as you're scaling something that fast. But I mean, for you, what's been one of your favorite parts of being able to have this thing that's taking off?
Yeah, so I enjoy all the opportunities that come from it, of like actually being able to go to an event and say like, someone's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I run ConvertKit. And they're like, whoa, really? I use ConvertKit. Like I was at a conference and there was this bus ride back from one of the evening activities. And so it's this bus ride at night. It's dark. I'm sitting next to this guy named Josh and we're talking, and, not you. And you know, we're talking for a while and talking about like places we visited in Thailand while traveling and all this stuff. And then like 15 minutes in, he's like, hey, so what do you do? And I was like, oh, I run ConvertKit. And he's like, oh, we've used ConvertKit for years. And like, it was just that fun experience of like, we're so far into a conversation, and I'd actually was really familiar with his blog and all this stuff and didn't realize who he was either. But like that kind of thing from it is really fun. Probably the other thing is we've put such an emphasis in being profitable and then investing not exclusively in things that we think will get us a return of like, hey, we have to grow at this rate, so like spend all this money on Facebook ads or whatever, but instead on like projects that we want to see in the world. So we shot this documentary on how bloggers earn a living, and like traveled to 10 different cities and hired a film crew. And, you know, this whole project, I don't know, probably cost like $85,000. And it's something that we don't expect to make a return from, but it's something that we wanted to exist and we wanted to get out there in the world. And so we get to just spend money on it. And the same thing, like we decided to host a conference because, as arrogant as we are, we're like, we can do better than the bajillion other conferences that are out there. And we ended up creating this amazing experience. And, you know, it was truthfully like one of the greatest conferences I've ever been to. And people were like, wow, this is a first year event. Like, it's so polished and the talks are so good. And like, we had Seth Godin keynote the event, and we, you know, it was this amazing experience, and we lost a ton of money on it. But it was like that it was half a month of profit that we lost on this event. And it was like, oh, like on one hand, you know, well, I mean, we only brought in half the expense, like for, only half of the expenses of the event were covered with revenue. And we're like, oh, this is so much money. But then it was like, you know what? We get to do these projects because we've built a profitable SaaS company.
Right. Well, and like stuff like that, to some extent is a branding play, right? I mean, like you're making yourself known, like you won't, but you won't see the return. You might not see returns on that for months or years, but you probably will see some kind of return on it, you know?
Yeah. We tend to not flush money down the toilet. Yeah. We have some idea of, what we're doing there.
So you guys also do, I mean, you mentioned spending, or investing profits, in other things than just like growth. You guys also do profit sharing, right? Or at least bonuses that are kind of attached to that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we do. And we've tried it a few different ways, but, we've kind of come to a little bit of a system on it, and that's where we do at each of our team retreats. So we do two team retreats a year, one in the summer, one in the winter. And, you know, we just look back at the goals that we've hit, you know, what the profitability from that time period is, and then pay out a portion of those profits to the team. So this last time it was $200,000, or I guess $225,000, split between, we have, 28 people now. And so the average check size was something like $8,000, for the previous 6 months. So it ended up being pretty significant. And we distribute that based on two things. So one, 25% of it is distributed just based on time with the company. So, you know, you've out of all the days worked at ConvertKit, you know, you've been here for, you know, 400 of them. And so this is like the portion that you get based on that. And then the other thing is we have this internal kind of rating system of how we, determine performance. And so the other 75% of your profit sharing bonus is determined based on your performance in the last 6 months. And that's just a 0 to 4 scale, that we tried out, and it seemed to work well. So we're going to refine it a little bit, but it's basically like 0 is, hey, we should have fired you. Actually, I don't know why we haven't fired you. And so let's take care of that now. We haven't ever used the 0. A 1 would be like, hey, you're doing good work and we believe in you, but you're not hitting your KPIs. And then a 2 would be you're hitting, like we set high expectations and you're hitting your KPIs. You're hitting, doing great work that we expect. And then 3 would be you're going above and beyond in some really remarkable way. And then a 4 is like going above and beyond in some remarkable way that like truly moved the business forward, you know. And we've never given out a 4, but so kind of rating people on that. And then you come to like for every one of those performance points that you get, it has a dollar amount tied to it. And so, you know, that's the balance for whoever's doing great work. And then we have another part of the formula to like cut down the amount if you just joined, you know, so someone who was only there for like 2 months of the 6 month profit sharing period, you know, only gets that smaller percentage. But yeah, it resulted in like people who had just joined getting like $500 to $800, and then, all the way up to the top performers who had been there the longest were getting, I think the biggest check was 13,500.
What was that? What was the team's response to that? Like when you guys started doing the profit sharing?
Oh, they love it. Especially because the first time we did it, it was an absolute total surprise. So we did it at our first team retreat, and this was really fun because we, another thing that we've done a couple times, and we don't do it every time, we try to keep it as a total surprise. We've done like the first team retreat. It was the first time most people had met each other. And so we, Ashley, who's our director of operations, she and I had picked out individual personalized gifts for every person on the team. And so we'd set kind of a budget of about $100 per person. And it was just like, okay, what do we know about this person? Okay, they like hiking, the outdoors, you know, this kind of stuff. And we try to come up with something that fits them. And we'd like stalk their Pinterest pages to see what they'd pinned and to get an idea for the kinds of things that they would want. So we as a surprise on the first night, we like bring out all these giant boxes and like pass out gifts, and everyone absolutely loves it because it's like the pair of running shoes that someone really, really wanted, but you know, hasn't bought yet, or like all this stuff. Cause we really researched it and people loved it. And they like the whole group kind of devolved as everyone's, like showing each other what gifts they got. And then one of our team members had, we always do our retreats in like these big houses. And one of our team members had baked a bunch of chocolate cookies. And so everyone's like eating dessert. And I'm like, hey guys, okay, we have another thing that we need to do. And so we're like, you know, like wrangle this chaos back together and get everyone's attention again. And then surprise them with the profit sharing checks. And so then it was like, people loved it. And they still just talk about it to this day. So
like, how do you, I imagine you'd like sitting or standing or whatever up front and then just like taking it all in, like all these people.
Oh yeah.
Know. I mean, that's a pretty good feeling.
When anyone on my team, oh, it is. And anyone on my team will tell you that I cry pretty easily in front of big groups. And so, yeah, it was funny. Like, there's a few other people on the team who like get really surprised. And like this next time everyone expected profit sharing, and we told them, hey, this is the formula. But the checks ended up, even though we'd given them the formula and even a spreadsheet where you, cause we always like people to know, to like feel control over their jobs and their earning and all of that. But I'd put $100,000 in this formula or in the spreadsheet as like the example profit sharing amount. And everyone thought that would be the actual profit sharing amount. And so we still, even though they knew they were getting checks and then, you know, the size still totally surprised them. So I have that on video of people like I have this video of like just one person on the team that just like so surprised and happy because the check is about double what she expected, you know? So there's stuff like that that's fun. It's harder and harder to do surprises. Sure. So we mix it up. One other thing that we did this last time that we're going to keep doing at more team retreats or try to come up with other things is like, we've done all this to reward the team. And we talk a lot about ConvertKit existing as a company to help like bloggers and creators earn a living from their work. And so that's why we do the conference. That's why we do the documentary and all of that. But then we decided to do something else new. And that was, what we did was at the retreat, we talked about how, okay, all of this is great that we can help someone like start an audience and then make their first $10,000 online or their first $1,000 or whatever. But like, let's try to think beyond that to everyone who doesn't have even those opportunities. And like, let's go to some more basic needs of like clean water and housing and education and stuff like that. And so what we did is what we called charity night, and that's where we took $10,000 and we pre-divided everyone up into groups. Cause at this point the team's 28 people. And so people don't spend as much time with each other as you might expect. You know, or they tend to spend more time within their teams. And so we divided everyone up based on who we thought didn't know each other very well into these groups of four or five people. And then said like, okay, you have 30 minutes, go away and come up with, like basically what we're going to do is we're going to give away this $10,000 in $100 increments. And you have 30 minutes to figure out which organizations you want to give to. And so like each group of four people has to come up with like 16 organizations. And so what ended up happening that was super cool is everyone did that. That was a great experience to feel, you know, to have that feeling of giving back, but then also as we came back together, people shared some of their favorite organizations that they gave to and why. And what that did is you learned stories about people that you probably never would have heard otherwise. Because like the charities that people support ends up being a really personal thing. Like a lot of the reasons behind it. And so, you know, you'd find like someone gave to this, I'm trying to think like this organization for, like Hodgkin's lymphoma, because like their, you know, one of their parents had died from that, you know, and, you know, and other people were like, on a much lighter note, like, oh, they really wanted to support this pet rescue organization or, like all these different organizations, and people would share the stories behind it. Why, you know, and someone else was like, oh, I wanted to support this organization that helps, underprivileged kids like go to college and like helps facilitate that process because she was the first in her family to go to college. And so, you learn all these stories that you never would have heard otherwise. And it just brings the team so much closer together. And so that was one thing that we did this last time that was really, really fun.
That's good stuff. So let's, kind of wrapping all this up. So two more questions. So, one, what for you has been a key part of the success for ConvertKit?
Oh man. I mean, probably the perseverance is a big thing. Cause like, obviously we wouldn't be here today if I decided to shut it down instead of doubling down. And then that wasn't even an immediate change. And so, I don't know. I guess I feel like people are looking so much for like that one weird trick to accelerate growth or something like that. And often you're just going to have to put in way more time than you think. And that's what I did with the direct sales. You know, it's not scalable. It's not, I don't know, it's not sexy, but like it seriously works. And
how do you know when to persevere or like throw in the towel?
I mean, if it's on a project overall, I would go back to that, in the show notes, we can link to that blog post on when to shut down or double down. Cause those questions, I think actually work pretty well. And I've heard from a bunch of people that they've used that same framework and it's helped because there's absolutely times where you should be like, look, this isn't working. I'm not the right person for this. The timing's wrong. Something like there's a lot of projects that should be shut down, you know? And so it's definitely not as easy as like, you know, just stay at it for 4 years and then
eventually it'll turn around.
It'll all work out.
Cause I mean, I would say the ConvertKit story is, I mean, extremely atypical where, you know, something all of a sudden 2 years in when things have not been doing much of anything. And then all of a sudden really, really took off, you know? I mean, like, I don't know. I can't off the top of my head think of any other stories like that. So it's pretty rare, but I think like the danger is like, it's easy to get stuck doing something and holding out hope for way too long. You know, it's a fine line.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It really is. So then last question here, what's the next year look like for you in ConvertKit? Like you've had a super busy couple of years here. What's the next year look like? Is it just a repeat of the past 2 years or what's sort of on the horizon?
Yeah, so this year we did something really big and like reimagined the product from the ground up, and that resulted in us building out these amazing new visual automations. And it's just like the product is now an absolute joy to use. So we've got to finish building out some of that functionality, and you know it's rolled out to I think like 600 or 700 customers right now, and so we need to get it to the other 14,000 or so. And that's a giant project, but then it's really like, okay, now that we have this new user experience and this new functionality, like what does that enable from a growth perspective? So what new accounts can we get? How can we push things bigger? So we're like starting to spend more on acquisition, like, trying to do, you know, these bigger, whether it's big podcast sponsorships or getting even bigger names using the product or like just trying to think, okay, like how can we have another inflection point in the growth? And then with that, we're really good at like, I think I'd call it like hustle driven growth. And that would be the kind of things I'm talking about, like the direct sales, or then you use direct sales to get a webinar and that drives like that one webinar drives $1,000 of MRR. And so, you know, you're like stacking these things on top of each other and it's just done through pure hustle. And we're great at that. But at some point you need better systems to drive growth of like, yeah, we have our Facebook ads dialed in and our conversion rates and, you know, our content marketing. And, oh, by the way, we get a lot from search and all that kind of stuff. And we've always been really bad at that kind of thing. And so probably the last 3-4 months have been trying to get a lot more of those systems in place and analytics. So like now we can finally, like I can point back to any promotion we've ever done and find the exact, the current MRR, the total customers, the total net revenue and the exact churn for each of those promotions. Exactly. But that took a ton of work to be able to get to that level. So yeah, now it's really like scaling up and sustainable, systems for growth.
You're basically next couple years. 15 years later, getting to like realize your love of systems from Wendy's and putting it into place in software. You're getting back to like your roots here in fast food.
Yes, exactly.
Oh man.
Totally.
Well, cool, man. Well, that's all I've got. And I mean, thanks for hopping on a call. It's been great catching up and I appreciate you doing this.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Thanks for having me. We'll talk again soon.
And there we have it, Nathan Berry of ConvertKit. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me a note at josh@baremetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends really does go a long way. Thanks again.